Thank you very much for coming, everybody. We are here to talk about Windows Azure and SharePoint. Windows Azure enables scenarios that many customers today just simply can't afford. And they're also the same scenarios that those customers cannot afford to do without. So we're going to show you how to leave this conference to be able to deliver real technical value back to your business through cloud virtualization. And we're going to do that by three simple steps, answering why, how, and who's already blazed the trail, and who's already doing this. Let's start with the question of why. You already know SharePoint on-premises. That has an S in the word, by the way. If anybody says on-premise, I know a few Microsoft people are going around and hit with a sock and hitting people. It's on-premises. So on-premises, you're responsible for all of the stack. And it's not just SharePoint and SQL. You probably know this part already. You're responsible for not only SharePoint and SQL, but also the operating system, the patching, the everything for that. But also, that includes things like networking and storage, all the routers and switches and everything that is required. You have to manage that. And that really impacts your total cost of ownership. So on the complete opposite end of that spectrum is software as a service. Software as a service allows you to subscribe to the service without any commitment to having to manage any of that infrastructure or even the application or the data. All of that's completely managed by Microsoft. Windows Azure started as a platform as a service where developers could build solutions and they would manage their applications and data and push those out to Windows Azure that would allow then the ability to, using that fabric underneath, to be able to build these compelling solutions without having to manage the network and everything underneath it. But there are certain workloads that really don't fit this model, SharePoint being one. That's why we would introduce something like infrastructure as a service, or Windows Azure Infrastructure Services, to be more precise. Windows Azure Infrastructure Services allows you to run virtual machines in the cloud. And there are a lot of benefits to that we're going to see throughout this session. But most importantly, you don't have to worry about the storage. You know, the SAN storage manufacturers are not going to like to hear this, but you don't have to worry about that part because that's what Azure provides. The networking capabilities, that's what Azure provides. So it removes that ownership burden from you, allowing you to focus on the operating system and up, allowing you to focus on delivering the business results without having to worry about managing all the infrastructure tax that is associated with it. Now let's put that in SharePoint terms. SharePoint on-premises allows you to have full control of the environment. If you need to scale, you can buy more servers, you can provision those, you can then network them in, you can manage that and build all of your solutions using partner products and being able to develop full trust code solutions. Hopefully, you're starting to adopt the app model as well. But it allows you full control of that environment, which is also its downside is you're responsible for the full control of that environment. If you need high availability, that's on you. If you need disaster recovery, that's also on you. If you need to scale, that means purchasing more servers. And it's that capital expense that becomes prohibitive for a lot of customers to effectively scale and manage their SharePoint environment. That's why we would say that Office 365 should be your first choice for new SharePoint workloads. If you're doing simple collaboration, team sites, things that don't have those full trust code solutions and don't have a dependency on a third-party solution, then choose Office 365 first. It gives you the most cost-efficient means, and you don't have to worry about the high availability, the scale, or anything like that, because that's all managed by Microsoft. But there's a lot of things that Office 365 can't do for our customers today. Things like public-facing internet sites. There's some features that aren't in Office 365 yet that customers need to be able to build solutions. So that's where provisioning virtual machines in the cloud makes a lot of sense. And that's exactly what we're going to talk about today is the value of provisioning those virtual machines in the cloud. The benefit here is that you have 100% of the API surface area, meaning those third-party products and your own custom applications, full trust code, can all still work in this environment. And it also allows you to easily migrate from your on-premises environment out to the cloud, because you can almost do a lift and shift operation out to the cloud with your existing applications. And further, you also have the capability to continually scale simply by provisioning new virtual machines, avoiding the capital expense of having to maintain the life cycle of those machines over a 3-year cycle. High availability, disaster recovery, and scale is still for you to manage. So you'll still need to concern yourself with high availability using things like SQL Server always-on availability groups, and also using disaster recovery using either asynchronous replication or log shipping. Benefit of using SharePoint Windows Azure is the service level agreements. We have 99.95% SLA, which means that's roughly 4.38 hours of downtime per year. And what's covered in the SLA are things like patching the operating system, the host operating system. Because remember, it's virtualized, so they'll need to patch the host operating system on a regular basis. So you'll need to be aware that that's one of the operations that they take for you, that they manage for you. But they don't patch your guest operating system. That will still be your responsibility. The value for doing this. Now let's really dive into the why, because one of the big valuable things to me is I'm primarily a developer. And being a developer, I work with a lot of developers who have these big honking laptops like this thing. It is dual SSD, 32 gig RAM with 16 cores. And that's just to be able to run virtual machines locally on this machine. And that becomes really cost prohibitive for developers. For organizations that have multiple developers, having this kind of hardware available is really a challenge. What you can do is quickly provision new virtual machines out in the cloud that those developers can use, and here's one better. You can also provision test environments. So as you provision these test environments, you can simulate what your on-premises installation might look like out in the cloud, but then when you're done with it, you can then tear it down. Because you don't have to sustain that capital expense. Run the load test for the duration that you need, and then after that, tear that environment down so you're no longer incurring that cost. Another value is SharePoint is still a complex solution to manage. So that's why we have to rely on partners and consultants and contractors to work with our companies to be able to deliver the type of solutions that we need. Those individuals, as they come in and work on these solutions, one of the big challenges for a lot of organizations is that then they have to be added to Active Directory, and that can be a real cost for a lot of organizations. That process, after the contractor or consultant is onboarded, can still take weeks for them to obtain their Active Directory credentials. Using virtualization, you can provision an environment with a standalone Active Directory in the cloud, completely isolated and separate from your internal infrastructure, allowing that partner to be able to work in the cloud, and then again, when they're done, you can then simply tear the environment down. If you have MSDN, you already have access to Azure. A lot of folks don't actually know this. MSDN subscriptions come with up to $150 credit per month. So every month, you get a fresh new allocation through your Azure benefit, and that allows you to do dev and test for those solutions using that Azure subscription. Further, the cost per hour is significantly reduced, meaning that you can do a lot more using that credit per month, and you can also set a spending limit. So if you set a spending limit, such as I did, setting a zero limit, then what that'll do is simply turn those virtual machines off at the end of that cycle, and then refresh it at the next month, ensuring that I don't incur additional charges. Another great value for customers. So let me put a couple pictures in your head. The first one that I want to show is, if you want to do dev and test, I just said about how developers can spin up a new environment, but let's say that you have an on-premises installation. I should turn that off. We'll just leave it up and please don't, well, I can't say please don't tweet. So let's do this. We'll say settings, notifications, hide for 3 hours. There we go. We're back. Sorry about that. That's a comical diversion. So you have an on-premises installation, but you need to do dev and test. So I just said you can spin up a new environment in Azure. Here's another great thing that a lot of folks may not know is that Azure also includes now Visual Studio Online, which has load test agents. So I can spin load test agents up out in the cloud to be able to run load tests against that environment. And again, once I'm done with the load test, simply tear down an environment, ensuring that before I roll into production, that my solution will meet my capacity and performance requirements. For those MSDN subscribers, we have an exclusive offer. We have some images that are already available and pre-made for you that include SQL Server Developer, SharePoint, and Visual Studio already installed but not yet configured on the machines, allowing you to quickly spin up those environments. And we provide PowerShell scripts for you as well to quickly configure multiple machine environments. So again, easing the burden of getting started and making it easy for you to provision the type of solutions that you need. Here's another one. I've worked with a lot of customers. I used to be in Premier Field Engineering. And over the course of time working with customers, a very frequent thing that I would see is those customers would have on-premises installations with no disaster recovery plan at all. And when we probe about that and ask, and the reason why is often we can't afford a second data center. Azure can become that second data center, allowing you to then provision a new environment out in the cloud that can serve as your disaster recovery environment. But now you may be asking, how do I connect these two? You can simply open a virtual private network, VPN tunnel, and then that would allow you to do things like log shipping or asynchronous replication out to the cloud. So then you could perform failover out to that disaster recovery center while you then repair whatever disaster made you do the failover. This enables things like not having to patch at 3 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday. It enables you to fail over in a read-only scenario out in the cloud, do all of your patching on premises, then fail back, and now you're fully patched and ready to serve the customer workload. Here's another common scenario. Using SharePoint for public-facing internet sites or extranets. A lot of customers have a real challenge with this because the network requirements, things like putting Active Directory in a DMZ to be able to serve that SharePoint environment. I'm seeing heads nod like, yeah, we're fighting this one right now. And one of the benefits here would be instead of having to do that with your on-premises infrastructure, provision that out in Azure. So we provision that out in Azure, then that allows us to create maybe a web application, extend that to multiple zones. And the reason that you might want to use multiple zones here would be that your on-site site developers and authors can then use that VPN tunnel and access the default zone to be able to authenticate and author content. The visitors could then access the same information, the same site collections, the same data using port 80 anonymously. And further, here's real value is because the external partners and customers who need to authenticate, but you don't want to add them into your own Active Directory infrastructure, we could then provision Windows Azure Active Directory to be able to use the user information, and those partners and customers could then log in through that extranet zone and use that through SAML claims to Windows Azure Active Directory. So by way of demonstration, let me show you an environment that I've been working on for a few months in a proof of concept working with the TechNet content team. If you go to the Windows Azure portal, if we scroll down to the Windows portal, you can see that there's this section called Cloud Services. So I go into Cloud Services, and you can see that I've already created a cloud service here called SPVMs. When you create a cloud service, you give it a name, and that name is used as part of its URL. So the URL that I'm going to use here will be spvms.cloudapp.net. That'll be the public endpoint for that cloud service. Now remember that, spvms.cloudapp.net. That's going to be important here in just a moment. Next, we go to the virtual machines themselves, and I'll go to the SharePoint virtual machine that I've created. This one's called SP All-in-One. I just have one single SharePoint server in this environment, and I click that, and then I can go to the endpoints for that virtual machine. As I go to the endpoints for that virtual machine, you can see that I have some endpoints that are already provisioned for this virtual machine. I'll show you how to do this in a demo in a moment. But this allows me to open up a firewall rule for port 80, allowing access into the any machines in that cloud service to be able to access over port 80. Further, I can also do things like open up port 443. If I need to secure, maybe through SAML claims, I can use HTTPS. We also can have RDP open. This would be a port enabling you to remote desktop into the machines to manage them remotely. So to demonstrate that, let me show you. I'll just open up the remote desktop manager. And using remote desktop manager, you can see that I'm connected to spvms.cloudapp.net using a port. And the port is the port number that you just saw a moment ago. But I'm here in central administration. This part should be familiar to an IT pro audience. So I can go in, look at the web application. So let's click on the web application. And I have a single web application here called HNSC. And I'm using hostname site collections. And I'll go to the authentication providers. For authentication providers, you can see that I've already extended that to two additional zones. I have the default zone, an internet zone, and an extranet zone, using the same thing that we just saw in the diagram a moment ago. So now that we saw the three zones, and this is just, again, basic SharePoint stuff, let's then see how in the world would we resolve a name like www.blueskyabove.us to this site collection that I'm about to show you. So I view all the site collections, and you can see that I do have a root path-based site collection, but I also am using hostname site collection, so I'm able to give it a URL such as publishing.corp.contoso.com using a non-standard port. And this allows that the internal users can access that URL over that VPN tunnel or remote desktop to be able to access the environment, enabling them to use highly branded publishing sites, something that Office 365 right now doesn't quite make very easy. So you can see that I'm using managed navigation. I'm able to customize master pages. I can use all the new SEO capabilities, including using cross-site publishing, and all this, again, using this inside this environment. So these internal site authors can also go in and author content, adding a page. As they add a page, I'll just give it a simple name like demo page, because I am that original. And I'll say create. And after it creates, I'll be able to then author some simple content that this is a demo page. Come on, Kirk, type faster. That you are typing slow. This is my demo page. I am not checking it in. And the reason I'm not going to check it in is I want to prove a point. Because the internal authors can author content, and then we're not going to check it in yet because we're going to show the experience of anonymous users. So now, how in the world did I resolve this URL of www.blueskyabove.us to be able to access remotely into this machine? Let me show you the site collection, git sp site, and I just showed you publishing.corp.contoso.com. That's my internal DNS, obviously not going to resolve externally. And I get the site, and you can see it really is a site collection. But there's a new thing in SharePoint 2013, it's called SP site URL. SP site URL allows me to assign a different URL for different security zones. So let me show you that in a slightly better format. Come on, show it as a format list. There you go. If I look at the formatted list, you can see that I have the default zone is where my internal users are going to access, but I also have an internet zone with the URL of www.blueskyabove.us. Okay, so that solves part of the problem. We gave a URL to the site collection so that SharePoint can respond to that. Now let's go take a look and see there's more to this puzzle. Because now we're going to need to see how does that name resolve. If you open this up on your laptops, your phones, you'll be able to go to www.blueskyabove.us. And you can see that I'm doing that on the screen now. And the way that you do that is you go to your registrar, and you'll be able to add a CNAME. You add a CNAME alias an alias is going to point, whatever name that you have for your domain is going to point to spvms.cloudapp.net. So it'll be your cloud service name.cloudapp.net. That's how each one of you, if you opened up on your Surface or your Windows phone, would be able to go to this site and resolve that. It needs a public DNS. There's one more part to this problem, though. IIS itself. When I extend the zone, and remember, I'm using a hostname site collection, so I have multiple URLs per zone. I extended it to multiple zones. So let's go look at that internet zone. And if I look at the internet zone and look at the bindings, you'll be able to see that I'm simply listening to all traffic on port 80. I'm not adding the bindings manually. By processing all traffic on port 80, that means as that call comes into IIS, it hands it off to SharePoint. SharePoint sees that alias name, looks up the hostname site collection, and serves the content appropriately. Now I can go to the public-facing site, blueskyabove.us, as an anonymous user, and notice in the navigation here, I'm able to quickly resolve, but I don't see that page. Just again proving it's the same content, but it hasn't been approved yet, hasn't been published. So since it's not published yet, now let's see another thing that we can do. And of course, we can go back and look at all the content. We can see that it's really fast, and it's only a single virtual machine because I'm using all the caching capabilities inside SharePoint. But I also have another zone that I've used, and it's called secure.blueskyabove.us. And this is the extranet zone that my partners are going to log into. Because I've hired a contractor that's going to author content for my site. So they'll be able to sign in, and first to prove that I could sign in with Windows Authentication here if I want. And of course, just like everybody else, I'm going to log in as the farm account, because that's how I roll. So we're going to log in as the farm account, and it's going to take just a moment, and we're going to see that, yep, system account. There we go. Who needs our real names? We don't need auditing. So we're logged in as a Windows account right now, and it's just to prove the point, if you wanted to, you could set it up this way. I would probably instead have this zone only authenticated using a trusted provider. So I've already pre-configured a trusted provider using Azure ACS to federate to Windows Azure Active Directory. And the name of my registration is blueskyabove.us. Using Windows Azure Active Directory, you should see that this looks pretty darn familiar to Office 365. And the reason why is because Office 365, when you sign in, also uses Windows Azure Active Directory. So I'll sign in, and once I'm signed in, you'll notice first that I am logged in as admin at blueskyabove.onmicrosoft.com. And second, I can now see the content that was started by my internal users, but as a trusted partner that's contracted with my firm, I can now continue authoring and continue the experience for that project. So now let's see, how does this stuff work? When you go to Windows Azure Infrastructure Services, there are several types of images that are already available for you to choose from. Obviously, we're at the SharePoint conference, we're talking about SharePoint, but it's worthwhile to know that it's not just SharePoint images and Windows. In fact, we have Linux distributions that are available. So if your organization has a dependency on Linux, you can absolutely provision Linux virtual machines in Windows Azure Infrastructure Services. Further, we recently announced a partnership with Oracle, where Oracle is also providing those images into Windows Azure, into the gallery, making them available for you to be able to build those workloads using Oracle. As you build a virtual machine, you'll need to choose a size. And this is kind of an eye chart, and it's on purpose. And the reason why is because I want to show you that there's multiple choices where you can start from extra small, which is a shared instance with one data disk, or I can go to all the way to A7, which is 8 CPU cores, 56 gigs of RAM, and 16 data disks. Now, thinking about the SharePoint capacity planning guidelines that hopefully everybody's familiar with, you would understand that the best choice here would be the extra large size, which would give you 14 gigs of RAM and 16 data disks with 8 CPU cores. Now, that's not quite the recommended recommendation of 16 gigs, but close enough, because the next size up will give you 28 gigs. You might actually need to consider the 28 gigs, though, for some of your application servers if you're doing something like Excel services, which would take more RAM than just the 16 gigs. So how does all this stuff really work? Well, if we select an image from the gallery, and I'll show you this experience in a moment where we'll actually create a new virtual machine, but as you choose an image from the gallery, you log into the Windows Azure Management Portal, and then you'll create a new image from the gallery. That image is then copied to your storage account, your Azure storage account. It's really just a download of a VHD. It's the same VHD format that you use with Hyper-V today. So you use it'll download the Hyper-V VHD formatted file, and then you'll create a virtual machine based on that VHD. If you have an existing VHD, you can also upload that to Azure Storage. And then once it's uploaded to Azure Storage, you then would be able to create a new virtual machine based on your existing image. This allows you to, in your environment, if you have an existing solution that you want to push to the cloud, you can simply create a virtual machine from that, sysprep it, upload it to Azure, and now create new virtual machine instances based on that sysprepped images. So with that, let's take a look at another demonstration, and we'll see how to use the management portal to create a new virtual machine. So logged in again to the Azure management portal. I'm going to scroll down all the way, and we're going to go look at the settings add-in. The settings add-in, we're going to click that, and then we're going to open up the settings. And the setting that I want to show you is this thing called an affinity group. SharePoint, you can imagine, would not be very happy if the virtual machine was running in North America and its storage was in Europe. So we want to reduce that latency by creating an affinity group, which tells it all resources that are associated with this affinity group should be located as closely together as possible. So I'll give it a name and a description, and then I'll say what region that I want the affinity group to be in. And I'm doing a project for some customer in North Europe, so I'll choose North Europe because it's closest to them. Next, after we create that affinity group, and you can see the status that it says creating the affinity group, and once it's done, then you'll be able to see the status in the bottom right where it'll come up and show the bouncing bars. Once the bars stop bouncing, then you'll be able to finally continue on with the rest of the demo. So now that we've created an affinity group, let's go look at storage. We create a storage account, and the storage account will be the container for those VHDs. So I can quick create, give it a name, and you can see that the name needs to be unique. So there might be somebody else that's already using the name SPC Demo Storage. Okay, I'll just add number 2 to it. Come on, hurry up. There you go, number 2. And now we need to say where that storage will be located. And again, we want the virtual machine and storage to be located as close together. I could choose a location, or I can simply use the affinity group, ensuring that all of the resources will be closely located together. Finally, I can choose the replication model. We'll talk about this in more detail in a further slide, but I'll just leave the default as geo-redundant. I'll choose create storage account, and then once the storage account is created, take a moment, we'll be able to see the status again in the Azure management portal. Once it's created, now we can move to the next step, which is creating a cloud service. If we create a cloud service, you can see that I already have a few that I've already created, but I'll show you how to create one. We go to the bottom left, and we click the new button. The new button will then prompt me to either quick create or custom create. There's two options for quick create, or if I do custom create, there's also two options. Well, plus one checkbox. So we'll give it a name. And again, the cloud service, the name has to be unique, and it checks to see that the name is unique. And then we have to choose a region or affinity group. And I want the resources, again, as closely located as possible. So I'll put the resources in the same affinity group. Finally, I'll choose OK. I'll point this out, and then I'll choose OK. And then once that's successfully created, that takes just a moment to create. Now we can finally move to the next step, which is actually creating the virtual machine itself. Now, if you wanted to create when you create the virtual machine, you could have either just created the virtual machine, or we can even specify network settings. As we create the network, this will allow us to create a virtual network that allows us to choose from either a 10-dot address or a 192 address to be able to specify that all of these machines will participate as part of a virtual network. So I'm going to show that I can choose how many addresses will be available in this virtual network. And the virtual network, I can choose the address space. Oh, get rid of that window. There we go. And I also want the virtual network to be part of that affinity group, ensuring that all resources are as closely located as possible. So I'll put it in that same SPDemo AG. And then the DNS server. If I have a DNS server that's already been provisioned, then I could use that domain controller. But for this demonstration, I'm simply going to choose none. And I'm just going to create a standalone image to show, just to prove a point that I create the SharePoint image and what's the experience after the fact. Now we have the virtual network that's been created. It's finally time to create the virtual machine itself. So I create the virtual machine. I'll go to the Virtual Machines tab. And then we'll go to the same button on the bottom left, which is new. We create the new virtual machine. And again, we have an option for quick create, which is more like a one-off creation, or I can choose an image from the gallery. With quick create, I can provide some details about it, or if I go to the gallery, I get a nice image to be able to choose everything visually. And it allows me to provide a few more settings than quick create does. So I can choose from some of the existing images, and here's where I was talking about the images that are available. There's Windows Server images available, or there's some images that are provided by external partners, such as Oracle. Or we also provide an image where SharePoint is pre-installed but not yet configured. So we'll choose the SharePoint Server trial image. And it's a trial image. So what you'll need to do is after you roll this in, if you want to go to production, you'll need to provide your own product key for that. So now we choose the image size. And this is why I pointed out the size before, where we could have chosen either large or A5, but we're going to choose that extra large size that provides the 14 gig memory. And again, reminding you that the 28 gig memory might be needed if you're going to do something like Excel services, something that has memory requirements. We'll have a username, spadmin. It does not allow password 1. So I'll change that to password 2. There we go. And I'll confirm. It's not really password 2, if anybody's wondering. Now I go. The next thing I'll do is I'll choose a cloud service. I can either, from here, I could create a new cloud service with all the settings that by default, or I can choose from all of the different assets that we've already created. I'll choose an existing cloud service. I can choose the existing virtual network, which is also part of that affinity group, and the storage account, which is also part of that affinity group. I can also choose an availability set, and we'll talk more about availability sets in a further slide. Availability set. Think of this as high availability for roles. If I have two web front ends, I want those to be on two different machines such that if the power to one is lost, the other one can continue running. And that's exactly what an availability set will provide. So I'll just create a quick availability set. Finally, here's those endpoints that I pointed out before. By default, we create two endpoints for you. One is for remote desktop, the other one for PowerShell remoting. And you could also add your own endpoints here. So you'll be able to choose from what protocol do you want, such as we want to add a publicly accessible HTTP endpoint for this virtual machine. This is exactly how you would open that up. We could also add an SSL endpoint, allowing port 443 traffic into the virtual machines as well. So once we have that, we then go click Create. And through the magic of video editing, you'll see that this doesn't actually take very long. We'll be able to see the status, and if we go look, we'll see that it's telling us the status, is running, provisioning. This operation actually takes a few minutes to do. Rather than attempt this in front of a live audience, I thought much better to have a pre-recorded video that I could trim some time out. We can see the status. We can look at details, so let's go click the details button to see what's the details of creating the virtual machine. There we go. We see that it's provisioning the virtual machine SPC VM demo. And then once the virtual machine is successfully created, the last step is to actually go log in. So once the status is actually running, we can go to the bottom of the screen and you'll see an option to connect. Clicking that button to connect will allow me to go to the remote desktop connection and be able to remote desktop into the virtual machine. So I'll click open. Click open. Really was stressing open there. So we click open, and then I'll mistype the password just a few times. And you'll see here, if I start typing spadmin, I want to point one thing out, because it's trying to pass domain credentials. And the domain here is my North America credentials. That's my Microsoft domain. I don't want that spadmin in a North America domain, so I'll need to do ./ in front of it to say use the local, use basically a workstation account. That'll change it to the name of the local machine, and then I'll mistype the password, and then I'll fumble through this for just a moment and show you that you'll need to remember the password, because there is no "I forgot my password" here. You'll need to remember what password you typed. But once you successfully remember your password and you log in, the virtual machine will then start in the remote desktop, and you'll be able to administer it from there. I'll log into the virtual machine, and what I'm going to do is, instead of keeping it maximized, I'm going to move it over, because we're going to do one other operation to it. So while it's logging in, we're going to kind of minimize that a little bit, and we're going to go back to the portal, and we're going to do something very interesting, because having been in Premier Field Engineering, which is a support organization at Microsoft, a lot of customers run out of disk space on a very frequent basis. And it's a hard problem, because when you run out of disk space with SharePoint, it gets sick. So what I'm showing you is that SharePoint's installed but not yet configured. So if you need additional disk space, this is another huge thing about running in the cloud, because I can simply go to the Azure Management Portal and click Attach. When I click Attach, that's going to allow me to attach an empty disk. When I attach an empty disk, that's going to provision a new VHD file in my blob storage account, and then I'll be able to provide a size. And let me give it a weird size, like 74, so it kind of stands out, and we'll be able to see it. So we'll create that image. It'll take just a moment. It says it's running and it's updating the virtual machine. And then once it's updated, let's go back and see. Yeah, the virtual machine is still responsive while it's doing that operation. And then once it's done, we'll be able to go into storage and see that that disk was just added while the virtual machine was running. We didn't stop the virtual machine. So I'll go into disks, and we'll see that new disk has been added to the server. And we can see there's my weird size, 74 gigs. And then, so I'll be able to go to that, right-click, and say that now I need to initialize it, and I need to format the volume, and it should be next, next, done. It takes a moment for to click through, next, next. We're going to give it a drive letter of F, just again to point out that it actually will have that disk there. Next, next, create. There we go. And now we'll be able to see all the progress images. It'll take just a moment for those to complete. And once those progress images are done, then now I can go back to File Explorer on the machine and see that I now have a new F drive. And I now have 74 gigs of additional storage. I can create up to 1,023 gigabytes. Not 1024, 1023. So I guess there's zero based in Redmond. So I just really wanted to point out the fact that you can add additional storage on the fly for your environment. Now, how does all this disk stuff work? You might have heard the term persistent disk before. Persistent disk is really the ability for you to store those VHDs and all of those, everything that is written to it is persisted and kept in Azure. So if you shut down the virtual machine, the next time you start it, those same settings are there. So we have virtual machine, and we write to Azure Storage. But when we write to Azure Storage, we take care of the disk subsystem for you, including the high availability and protection of disks, which means we'll do two additional writes to disks, ensuring that we're fault tolerant at the disk layer. Now, if you remember, when I created the virtual machine, I also had a choice of locally redundant storage or globally or geo-redundant storage. For geo-redundant storage, we will also do three additional writes to another data center that's close to that region, such as from East US to West US. So I'll be able to write those three, and the benefit there is that as my virtual machine may suffer a failure, such as data center failure or whatever, I would still be able to have access to those disks to be able to read and possibly provision a new virtual machine using those disks. So the value, again, is protection at the storage level. Now, why would you choose one versus the other? Cost. Locally redundant storage, if you don't need that geo-redundant capability, will if you use just local redundant storage, it'll save you about 30% in the charges for storage. So I talked briefly about affinity groups. And an affinity group is just like you would design your SharePoint environment on premises. You're going to put everything in the same data center. And that's exactly what we're telling Azure is, put everything in the same data center. Put everything as close together as possible. Not necessarily, let me back that up. Put everything in the same data region. And it's going to manage that, and it's going to attempt to put everything in the same data center. It's going to manage that for you. But we don't have guarantees about which data center. You only tell it which region that you want this to be applied to. Further, we have a concept called availability sets. If you're going to design an on-premises installation, you're going to have probably at least 2 web front ends, at least 2 application servers, at least 2 SQL databases. And the reason why is because should one go down, the other one is available to handle the traffic. So that's exactly what an availability set would provide, is that SLA guarantee that I talked about at the beginning of the talk, where that SLA guarantee provides the ability for me to have multiple virtual machines provisioned that are fault tolerant. So should one go down due to loss of power at the rack or some other reason, the other one would be available to serve that traffic. Let's talk about connectivity. This is a common question. Now that I provision these virtual machines, what can I use to connect to them? What can I use? What protocols can I use? You see that we have UDP support, UDP traffic support. We also have the ability to do IP-based communications, virtual machine to virtual machine. I also showed you an example of port forwarded endpoints, where I created an endpoint for port 80, and I showed you how I could use a port forwarded endpoint to be able to connect to that cloud service. Virtual machines in DNS. You have full control over the virtual machine names, and you can also add your own domain controller and DNS that it would use to resolve. And I showed you an example of that in the previous demonstration. When I use corp.contoso.com, I have a domain controller that I use in Azure, and SharePoint in Azure still requires an Active Directory domain services domain controller for SharePoint. It's still required. You can't just use Windows Azure Active Directory. We're not there yet, maybe one day, but we're not there yet. So an interesting thing that I also pointed out was this VPN concept. We have 2 VPN options. One is a site-to-site. And site-to-site allows me to do something like set up a gateway. So I can go from my on-premises data center to be able to connect through a hardware VPN or Windows Routing and Request Access Server, something new in Server 2012 R2, to be able to access that remote endpoint. So I have options to be able to configure that to be able to do site-to-site, meaning that I don't have to have each individual machine or user install an agent to be able to connect remotely. That's a competitive advantage that Windows Azure has. But if you have a need for the ability for those remote workers instead to not have that site-to-site VPN, we also offer an ability to do a point-to-site VPN. And the point-to-site VPN is going to look more like when you actually VPN from your machine. So let me demonstrate that really quick and show what that looks like. So the VPN here, what I'll do is I'll go to networks, and I already have a network that I've installed, and it's called SP Auto VNet. I'll show where that came from towards the end of the talk. And what I'll do is I'll simply export the virtual network to an XML file. And I'll store that locally, and I'll show you, because when you have a virtual network, you can actually make changes and see what's in that virtual network. So I'll just open it in Visual Studio, and we'll be able to see some settings, such as the DNS server. It's pointing to a machine called DC1 with an IP address. There's virtual network address spaces, so I can design multiple subnets for the virtual machine network. And then I can also add in a new subnet. And the subnet is going to be my gateway subnet. Easiest way is just copy one of the existing ones, replace it with a new name, and give it a new IP address prefix. So I'll do it 1020.3. Then we'll need to add in a new element, and this will be our gateway. And the gateway will allow me to add the VPN client address pool. And the VPN client address pool will allow me then to configure the settings for if those users are going to VPN in, what would be the address pool? And ours will be the address pool of 10.0.0.2 using CIDL format 24. Next, we go to the virtual machine itself, the virtual network, and we then need to import that XML file back to Azure to save our changes. So we'll take the XML file, save it back to Azure, allowing me to make changes to that virtual network offline. So I save those changes. We can see that it detects an update, and then it will actually update the virtual network. Once we update the virtual network, then we can see that a virtual network gateway has been created, but I need to configure it, and I need to add a certificate. So that what I'll do is I'll click this button that says Create Gateway. This operation can take over 40 minutes to do, thankfully, through the magic of video editing. You'll be able to see this in a much faster time frame. It takes about 40 minutes to do the changes in Azure. Next, the certificate. This is the part that a lot of people may not understand because admittedly, we don't have the best examples that are online. We have some great documentation, but examples leave maybe a few elements to be desired. So we're going to use a self-signed root certificate, and we're going to do that through a years-old tool called MakeCert. MakeCert, we're going to tell it that the key type exchange, come on, the dash R is going to tell me that this is going to be a root certificate. The name, we're going to give it a container name of CN equals my Azure root. Really doesn't matter, just give it a container name. And then we're going to tell it that it is public, that public key is exportable, the private key is exportable. And then we're going to tell it the algorithm will be SHA-1, and the length of it will be 2048. Then after that, we're going to say that the store that it's going to be created in will be the local private store, the My Store. After that, we need to create then a client certificate based on that self-signed root certificate. So the client certificate, we're going to give it a name of My Azure Client just so it kind of stands out. And then we're going to tell it that the private key is exportable. We're going to tell it the key type is Exchange. Then after that, we're going to tell it some more information that we just saw. We're going to give it the month's duration is going to be, we'll tell it 96 months that it's valid. And after that, the store will be My. And then the parent, the root certificate, where is it located? And it's located in the My Store. And the reason that we're doing this is because we're going to upload the private key to Azure. The self-signed root certificate is going to be uploaded to Azure. But this client certificate will be distributed to any machine that needs to connect using a VPN connection. So by creating this self-signed root certificate and a client certificate based off it, that's going to allow this secure certificate-based connectivity out to Azure. And once I've run those commands, I'll be able to go into Certificate Manager and see those two certificates, and I'll need to first export the root certificate. Exporting the root certificate is fairly simple. Just right-click, export, next, next, next. So we'll go to All Tasks, Export, and you'll see Welcome to the Certificate Export. No, do not export the private key. I want the default X509 cert. I'll go to the next one, give it a file name. Where is it going to store it? I'll give it a name here real quick. And I'll go into my demo folder and say that it'll be My Azure Root. Just so I can remember which one's the root, which one's the client. Finally finish. Now we need to export the client. When we export the client, there will be some slight differences to what we just saw. We'll do next, and now we'll say yes, we do want to export the private key. We'll export the private key, and then we'll go to next. We'll leave the type as .pfx. And then we can provide either a group or username or a password. I'll give it a password and choose next. Give it a file name, where am I going to store this new PFX file? And I'll call it my Azure client.pfx. We choose next and done. Once the My Azure Client certificate has been created, now we need to go to the Azure portal again, and we'll tell it upload a root certificate. The root certificate that we just created a moment ago was that one that I called myazureroot.cer. So I'll go upload the public key portion. Next, and we upload the cert. At some point later, then we'll also need to then take that PFX and put it on a client machine. And we'll right-click that and say install certificate and tell it to install to local machine, not current user. We'll install to local machine, give it a file name, say next. And then from there, we're going to be prompted for the password that we just entered when we created the certificate. We'll do this on every client machine that we're going to distribute this certificate to. And this is going to ensure that every client machine then has that private key certificate that ensures secure connectivity. Now we can go back to the dashboard and see after a period of about 40 minutes that it takes for the gateway to be created, that finally the gateway should be created. And now to prove that the gateway has been successfully created, I can then click a link on the page to download the VPN client. I'll download the VPN client, and it has a nice little GUID as a name, so we'll go back and change that to VPN client so I can remember what the world.exe is. And then I'll call it Azure VPN client.exe and save it. Now here's another tip as you do this. As you download that, we're going to need to go unblock that executable. So you unblock the executable, otherwise it's not going to run successfully. So unblock it, and then we'll install it and say, yes, I want to install. Once we're installed, watch this. This is so cool. On Windows 8, then once it's installed, I'll go over to the charm bar, and there's a new VPN connection that shows up, SP Auto VNet. I'll click that, and this should look very familiar if you've done VPN work before, because I get a nice little Windows Azure Virtual Network. Do I want to connect? Sure. So I'll connect, and now once I'm connected, you'll see it takes just a second for the connection. I can now open up a command window and prove that I can directly connect from my local machine to a virtual machine in Azure as if it's on my local network, simply by doing a ping test to the domain controller, being able to do ping 10.20.2.4. That, to me, is just unbelievably cool. Thank you. Okay, so now let's look at some example topologies. I apologize. I didn't start the timer, but somebody did for me. Look at that, 22:25. All right. So we'll look at some example topologies. So I have about 20 minutes left. We're doing fantastic on time. So you may be wondering, okay, if I'm going to do this in Azure, what do I need to consider? What do I lose? What do I gain? And we'll take a look at how we did a proof of concept internally. We wanted to prove that using a sample medium-sized farm based on the guidance from TechNet, what would it look like if we were going to build this in Azure? So what we did is we used the same type of diagram that you saw a moment ago. We had 3 web front ends, 2 app servers, 2 SQL. And we have 2 domain controllers and a cloud service. And we also had a VPN tunnel to be able to connect. Expanding that, we'll be able to see that the size that we chose was the extra large size that I pointed out in the slide a moment ago, 14 gigs, using the 8 cores. And the things that we provisioned on these machines were the distributed cache, workflow manager, the front-end services, and also query processing component for the web front ends. And that's consistent with the guidance for a medium-sized internet farm, because you want the query components to be located for all the search components for those farms. The app server tier also looks very familiar because we use the same size and we have multiple disks. The disk size that we're using is pretty much the default, but we added a couple of disk sizes here, such as a log, as well as we have one to hold analytics data. The components that we provisioned to the admin server, or the app servers, were the analytics, crawl, admin for search, content processing for search, as well as any other additional backend services. The data server tier, though, SharePoint is a SQL application with a web front end. So thinking about it that way, SQL becomes really critical to the performance of your SharePoint farm. So it's critical to us to be able to provision all of those different files and all the different drives and locate all of the files for the content databases on various drives, splitting out the tempdb logs, the tempdb files, and having that separate from the page file. Now, this is an important point to remember. The C drive is going to be the system drive. Every virtual machine comes with a D drive. That D drive is going to be very blistering fast compared to the rest of the disks, and that's on purpose because it is a temporary drive, not meant for permanent storage. Should the virtual machine be located to another data center during disaster recovery, that D drive does not go with. This is not the place to go put stuff that you want to keep. Now, how would you deploy these things? Kirk, do I have to go to the Azure Management Portal for all this stuff? That was a lot of clicks. And doing it once during a demo, that was cute. Do I want to have to do that on a regular basis? No. And the reason why is because we have this fantastic technology called PowerShell. PowerShell allows you to then not only manage the virtual machines themselves, doing things like start Azure VM, stop Azure VM, which, by the way, if you've worked with PowerShell, you know that you can do things like use PowerShell in a Windows scheduled service. So you can set up a schedule on a daily basis that will call your PowerShell commandlet, and your PowerShell commandlet would be stop-azure-vm and give it some parameters for your VMs. That ensures that every night at that same time, your virtual machines are stopped and you're no longer incurring charges for those. So you can manage all aspects of the virtual machines. You can the virtual network settings I just showed, as well as the virtual machines themselves, storage, and automate other tasks. But we also have this other thing that I want to point out is the remoting endpoint. Because whenever we created the virtual machine, we got not only the remote desktop, but also a PowerShell remoting endpoint. PowerShell remoting endpoint allows me to use PowerShell to connect remotely to that server to not only manage the virtual machine itself, but the things inside the virtual machine. Why this is important? Because you can go download some automation scripts that are available for free off GitHub that would allow you to then quickly provision a virtual machine instance, or you can use the scripts from MSDN that are provided that work with those MSDN images I talked about previously. Or within PFE, we all use scripts that were written by one of my colleagues who's in the back. His name is Joe Rogers. We all use JoJo's scripts. And the way that the scripts from GitHub, they provision, I see you there. I was pointing towards the back. There's JoJo. So these GitHub scripts have two different options out of the box. You can configure them for your own needs, but they have two different script templates. The first one is single virtual machine. And that's one domain controller, one SharePoint server, one SQL server. Very minimal environment, great for developers, great to get started, great to learn how all this stuff works. There's also a template for highly available. And this one's really interesting because it provisions not only the web, application layer, SQL layer, the domain controller, but also will provision high availability using SQL server availability groups. For you, if you aren't familiar with how to do that, just double click on a script and it does all that for you, so you can go learn how to configure that. How it does that is a combination of the two techniques I just described a moment ago. First is the ability to access using PowerShell remoting, and second, the ability to use PowerShell to manage the virtual machines themselves. So as a reminder, I'll go to the virtual machine and show that there is a PowerShell endpoint here. And it's important to note that the public port here is 5986. Sorry, I didn't zoom in there. But the public port there for that is 5986. And we'll see that in a moment. And then the remote management endpoint is 53347. So the PowerShell port, if I'm going to connect over RDP, that would be 52532. But the remote management endpoint would be for this one is 53347. That's the one that we need. Remember, 53347. Because we're going to see that number pop open in just a moment when I open up PowerShell. So let's open up PowerShell. And we have PowerShell commandlets. You can download the PowerShell commandlets and use those within your environment. So git-azure VM would allow me to then get any Azure VMs that I provisioned out in my subscription. And I can see all the different VMs that I've created in my subscription. I could go back and get properties of one virtual machine. So I can do things like git dash or set, or I can do put or even delete or stop. So I can also look at the Azure services, those cloud services that I talked about previously. The cloud service is that SPVM's cloud service that I showed previously during the demo. So the SP all-in-one machine is in the cloud service SPVM's. So then we'll use git dash credential to prompt the user for credentials to go into that service. We'll get the Azure Win RM URI, and then we'll access properties from it, accessing the DNS safe host and the port. Once we run that script, we're prompted for credentials, just as you would expect. We provide the credentials to log in as the SP admin account, and we say OK. And now we'll be able to scroll down a little bit and see that we have some properties here. We have that $URIs variable. So let's inspect and see what's in that thing. If I look at the first item in there, I can see that I have properties such as the absolute path, the DNS safe host, and the DNS safe host is spvms.cloudapp.net. Now I need to look at so we remember that that's the cloud service, but we have a port. Let's look at the port, 53347. So we're saying go to that cloud service with that one specific port. That'll allow me then to access that virtual machine. And now I can say, given the remoting, I can use that computer and that port to establish a new PowerShell remoting session. So I do new PS session using that credential, computer, and port. And now since I do that, and by the way, you can do this on premises as well. Absolutely. I've worked with several customers and enabled this. They loved it that they could run this from their desktop to manage SharePoint remotely. Once we establish that session, now we'll enter a PS session. Notice how the prompt right now says, see users Kirky documents. Once I start a remoting session, that changes to the name of the cloud service, allowing me to do things like add PS snap in microsoft.sharepoint.powershell. I don't have SharePoint installed locally on this machine, but yet I can use the SharePoint commandlets because I'm not accessing this machine. Any command that I do is serialized and sent over to that remote machine. So now I can do things like git-sp-farm, git-sp-web-application, git-sp-site. I can access all the properties of that server remotely using PowerShell. Let's do git-sp-site, get the sp-site URL to remind you that we also showed this when we were RDP'd into the machine. And then just to also prove the point, I can also stop the remoting session. So let's exit the remoting session. And we'll notice how the command prompt changes, indicating that now, since it's changed the location, I'm back on my local environment. And if I attempt any of that git SP web application, git SP farm, any of that stuff, it's going to fail. Big red screen of death here that says, you don't have SharePoint installed locally. I can't find those commandlets. So proving again, I don't have SharePoint installed locally. So the abstract promised some case studies, and I just wanted to briefly cover some opportunities for that as well. First, who's blazed the trail? Telenor has done a fantastic job with SharePoint in dev test. So what they're doing is enabling their developers to quickly spin up those environments, but also provisioning test environments that mimic their final solution, enabling that exact scenario that I started with at the beginning of the talk. Toyota has also enabled their cloud portal, gazoo.com, also using Azure, using SharePoint, using publishing features similar to the previous demonstration that I showed you as well. There's several links that you'll want to be aware of. First is SharePoint 2013 on Windows Azure Infrastructure Services. It's a white paper that's available for you to go download and learn a lot about all of the different things you'll need to consider with Windows Azure, with SharePoint specifically. There's also those automation scripts. As I was working with those three machines, the SP all-in-one, DC1, and SQL, I created those with those GitHub scripts. I just provided a few parameters, double-click, creates those three virtual machines. I wait about an hour and a half. I come back after lunch. I have a new virtual environment completely ready for me to go and continue doing demonstrations at great conferences like SharePoint Conference. I have three sessions that I'm delivering this week. Obviously, the first one is the one on the left. That's the one that you're in today. But I'm also pointing this out for any other attendees that might see any of this content later. I'm also delivering a talk tomorrow, SharePoint apps with Windows Azure platform as a service. We're not going to talk about running your own virtual machines in the cloud with that one. We're going to show how you can take advantage of Windows Azure technologies with the new app model and how you can build extremely scalable solutions using Azure services as a developer. And then finally on Thursday, for the IT Pro audience that's here, this is a session that you would be really interested in. Because on Thursday, we're going to dive deeper into that public-facing internet site that I showed you previously, the blueskyabove.us. And we're going to specifically go into that and show how did I enable Windows Azure Active Directory as a trusted provider, and what were some of the considerations for doing that. We're also going to talk about disaster recovery. What are some of the learnings and scenarios that you're going to need to understand if you're considering using Windows Azure as your disaster recovery solution? I'm talking about that one with Ms. Brenda Carter, and she's part of the TechNet content group. We have content that's coming out on TechNet specifically talking about the lessons learned, the proof of concept, and it's not just from our group. It's from a number of subject matter experts on disaster recovery from across Microsoft, from the product team, as well as MCS and other individuals like the SharePoint Rangers program. There are several additional sessions as well. Luca Bandinelli and Sanjay Narang are presenting deploying highly available SharePoint internet sites, Windows Azure Virtual Machines. Additional considerations. This was an intro session. That one's going to go much deeper into high availability and things that you'll need to consider. There's also automated SharePoint disaster recovery with Windows Azure and Cloud Paks. And then finally, SharePoint business continuity management. If you're only interested in DR scenarios, this is the session to go to, bar none. This is by Neil Hodgkinson, and unfortunately Wayne Ewington wasn't able to attend the conference, but Neil is the expert on disaster recovery, and he has some interesting things to announce regarding supportability of different technologies for disaster recovery. Thank you very much. Oh, wait, one more. Please fill out your evaluations. If you found any bit of value, if you thought that this session could have at least paid for portions of your conference attendance, if not the entire thing, please rate highly. The only way that I'm able to come back is if you give me high scores. So ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for attending. Enjoy the rest of the conference. I'll take additional Q&A. The session is now over, but if there are additional questions, please step up to the microphone so those on the recording might be able to hear the questions as well.
Okay.
So starting first.
Yeah. So I saw in your one of initial...
Apologies. If you step up to the mic, you won't hear yourself. It's purely for audio capture.
Right.
So, yes. So I can hear you fine.
Okay. I saw one of the initial site, the URL was having two dots. So there was a third level subdomain in that URL. And as per the TechNet content and hostname site selection architecture design guideline, third level subdomain is not allowed. So I wanted to clarify what was that.
The question for those who didn't hear it was that there's guidance about a third level subdomain for hostname site collections not being supported.
Right.
I can assure you that everything that I just showed you is 100% completely supported.
So there is a conflict between what you are saying and what TechNet is saying.
If you'd like to follow up with me on Yammer, mm-hmm. go to the session Yammer feed and post that question there, and then I'll be able to copy in folks like Luca Bandinelli, who would mm-hmm. own that statement, who would be able to say what's the supportability statement specifically.
Yeah.
And if you could provide the URL for that would be a big help.
I'll do that. Second question was that I saw that you have, for extranet, you have extended the web application, though you are using hostname site collection. And I was somehow under impression that if you are using HNSC, then you can have multiple authentication provided with that, and you do not need to extend web application.
So the question here was that if I might paraphrase, why did I extend the web application three times
right.
instead of just having one zone for everything? And the answer is, if you have one zone for everything, remember that one of the zones required SSL, That means with hostname site collections, it's going to use just the properties of that one zone, meaning everything in that zone would have to be SSL. If I'm doing a public-facing internet site, I don't want it to be SSL. I want it just to be HTTP port 80. So for that reason, that's why I did not have the internet zone use 443, requiring multiple authentication types and protocol types. That's why I extended it to multiple zones.
But other than that, if I don't have that requirement, then I am fine with having multiple auth provider with one zone, right?
If you have a requirement that you can do everything with just SSL, absolutely, just use one web application with the default zone, you could absolutely do that.
And you also talked about partner organizations, and you used ACS as the authentication provider, but your partners may not be on ACS, but...
I'll talk more about that Thursday.
Okay.
For this session, this was simply an introduction to Azure, not necessarily a deep dive on the technical aspects of why we did it. But to answer your question, I used ACS simply to translate between SAML 2.0, which Windows Azure Active Directory provides, and back to SAML 1.1, which is all that SharePoint understands. So I simply used ACS because it's simple. I'm using Azure AD. You could use ADFS or another identity provider for the same exact purpose.
Thank you.
Yep, thank you very much. Next.
Hi.
Yes, sir.
On your chart where you showed the different virtual machine sizes.
I apologize, I couldn't quite hear.
On your chart where you showed the different virtual machine sizes.
Yes.
On the far right, you had a list for the number. It's almost like number of spindles. I know it's not spindles, but like on the machine you picked, it was 16 by 500 IOPS.
Thank you for catching that. I conveniently did not talk about the number of IOPS. So the number of IOPS discussion, it is 500 per disk. As I provision more disks, then I get 500 per disk. And that you can imagine then with some of the IOP hungry workloads that SharePoint provides, that can cause some consternation. Things like if I have 30,000 users that are all trying to do user profile sync, user profile sync is very IOP hungry. How does SharePoint perform in that instance? And for those, what we would recommend is move that work to dedicated disks as much as possible. And then you'll need to monitor to see if that meets your performance needs and goals. This would also be another great reason. If you actually have 30,000 users that you're trying to manage through this and using user profile sync, perhaps Office 365 might be a better solution for you. Windows Azure, I am not going to try to say it's going to absolutely meet everybody's needs for every scenario, but it's going to solve a lot of common problems.
Okay, so it's not like you're striping it and getting 16 times 500 IOPS.
We'd actually not recommend trying to stripe it.
Okay.
You will see much better performance using the architecture that I described.
Okay, so it's just as you add each additional disk to the VM, that disk is going to get 500 IOPS.
That's correct.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
All right, thank you all very much for coming. Enjoy the rest of the conference. All right. And feel free to come up here. I'm going to turn the microphone off now.